Hello and welcome to this latest edition of the MPFT podcast. For today's episode, we're going to be focusing on safe wards. This is a national model of care adopted by MPFT that recommends a series of positive actions staff on inpatient wards can take to reduce the risk of patients becoming aggressive or needing to be physically restrained. My name is Mark Fletcher, and joining me for this chat are
Steve Mine, Associate Chief Nurse.
And I'm Gary Firkins, the De-escalation Management Intervention Service Lead.
Thank you for joining me today, gentlemen. So, Steve, I'll start with yourself, if I may. In my introduction at the top of the episode, I gave a very brief outline of what safe wards is, but I appreciate it is more complicated than that. Could you expand on that for our listeners then, please, focusing on the benefits of this way of working and why MPFT supports its use?
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, safe wards then. Safe wards is a cultural model. So it's around changing the culture of our inpatient mental health wards. It has 10 modules. Each module has a different theme, and they're all around ensuring that we deliver the best patient experience and we create the best, most conducive therapeutic environments for patients as well. I think it's fair to say that, you know, wards, you know, can be difficult places. They can be very challenging. They can be very busy. And what the safe wards tries to do is focus on two elements, conflict and containment. So we can see in psychiatric wards and mental health wards that, you know, conflict can be brought about in many different ways. So it could be acts of self-harm, violence, aggression. Could be a variety of measures. It could be smoking. So there's conflict in our environments. And what the safe wards modules attempt to do is try and alleviate some of that conflict through a series of quality improvement work, of challenging the way we do things, is questioning the way we do things, thinking about the language we use when interacting with service users on wards as well. The other elements around containment is basically used, you know, to it may be we give medication or we're observing patients. And what Safe Wards tries to do is try and make us question why we're using containment and how we can adopt more least restrictive measures to support the needs of the patient. So Safe Wards is a cultural model. It's a cultural shift. It's something that doesn't happen overnight. We encourage all our wards to adopt the Safe Wards modules. It's also part of our accredited standards that we have to meet for our training as well we deliver at MPFT. So we do monitor its use as well and its deployment across the organisation. I hope that answers the question, Mark. I think it's a difficult one to explain Safe Wards because there's so many elements to it. There's 10 modules, there's 10 interventions. We support all our wards, all our mental health wards in delivering the different modules and addressing some of those conflicts and containment conversations as well. And it is very much around the culture. It helps with the culture that we work in and the environments that we deliver care in. I hope that answers it, Mark.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. I'll, Gary, come to you next. So where we can bring in some more specific examples of this. So in your experience, how effective is the Safe Wards model, and are there any examples that you can give where it's helped to make a difference to put some meat on the bone of what Steve's just talked about there?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in terms of the research around Safe Wards, I mean, there's a number of differences it makes. It, as you mentioned right at the beginning there, Mark, it does massively reduce the use of restrictive interventions, and Steve's alluded to some of them, with things like having to physically manage people's behaviour, sometimes having to use medication to slow people's behaviour down, perhaps even controlling that by adopting different environments like seclusion or long-term segregation where we keep patients away from the general population. So Safe Wards on that level has been shown across the country, let alone within our own trust, to have a massive impact on that positively. It also, and this is a thing in today's climate, its use actually massively increases the use of the money we spend on the wards. So a lot of research says that up to £100,000 a year can be saved per ward in the costs related to managing challenging behaviour by the adoption of Safe Wards. So on a number of different levels, it's a really positive cultural thing to do with the staff. In my experience, the three main modules that seem to get the most traction to begin with are the clear mutual expectations, and certainly within mental health care and learning disability care, one of the things that tends to get in the way of care is almost like a perceived barrier between the care staff and the patients, in terms of, you know, we put people in an environment, they sometimes, well, actually a lot of the time, they can't leave of their own choice. There's some restrictive practices, things like, you know, sometimes you have to take their phones off people. There's national bans on things like smoking, that type of stuff. So it's about the environment we look after people in. And one of the things the Clear Mutual Expectations does is set it up so we're all in this together. So it's a joint initiative that we as a group of people, patients and staff and visitors on occasions, decide what the rules are and what the negotiating points are for the stay on the ward. Even really daft but simple things like, we all have an expectation that everyone's responsible for the hygiene of the ward. You know, it's not down to any particular person to maintain the cleanliness of the ward. Everyone's in it together. You know, we'll tidy up all our rubbish. We'll keep the place tidy. And once you start to that, you engender a bit of respect in the environment, and that can make a difference to people stay with us. The second one I'd say has a very good traction with the staff is the positive words module. And this is where we share information, particularly during handovers, about people's day with us. And you know, in the past, sometimes you could have said staff were less than positive about people's behaviours. Now, we're, because of the understanding that we've generated around the trust about why people might behave the way they do, our frustration, anger, mental health issues, we describe those very, very differently now, with that deeper level of understanding about why somebody might be frustrated about their care or their stay with us. So that's been massively useful in terms of setting up each shift to actually engage and interact with people on a much more positive level than has previously been done over the years.
Just out of interest, are we talking purely about mental health wards where this is applied, or is it sort of a physical health wards as well, for our listeners?
Generally, the areas that Safe Wards was designed for are adult mental health forensic units, which is the more locked units, psychiatric intensive care units. It's only just over the last couple of years that it's been redesigned and refitted for places like older adult care and learning disability care. Right. As yet, I mean, you could see how it would work in some areas like acute hospitals and community hospitals, but as yet, it hasn't been, to my knowledge, has been rolled out across those areas across the country.
Right.
So it's primarily mental health and learning disability. But you can see how it would work in some areas, because a lot of acute hospitals, a lot of their wards, as a secondary diagnosis, there are a lot of patients there with mental health issues. And quite a severe degree of mental health dysfunction at times. So I think it would be really useful for acute nurses to jump on board with it. But it's a big ask in today's climate, but there we are. The third module then would be the calm down box of all things, the practical things we can provide patients with when they self-report levels of anxiety, agitation. So rather than just sit down and talk with them or offer them medication, we actually give them practical things to do. A favourite at the moment are adult colouring books. They seem to be very, very good at helping people with their stress levels as a distraction and diversion. So, you know, you can go onto some of our wards and there you are, you've got the staff and the patients colouring. And it seems like a weary, weird thing to do sometimes, but it's really, really de-stressing for some of our patients. And the beauty of it is the patients get to choose what helps them. So somebody might come in with their own music, or they might come in with a stress ball even. You know, they get a bit of a bad rap, stress balls, but you know, they actually are very, very useful. So people can actually choose what helps them in times of anxiety. So those are the three modules I think get the most traction. The other seven are obviously massively useful, but those are the three that really do get some support from the staff, and the patients find them really useful.
And you were just mentioning there about the colouring books. I'm guessing that as time goes by, the how these modules are used by staff and the ways that and means that they are used changes over time with experience. So sort of leads on to my next question about, are you able to talk, Gary, about the way our staff are trained and how best to manage challenging and complex behaviours involving patients?
Well, it's very much in line, as Steve said, with the national certification. So we work to something now called the Restraint Reduction Network Standards. And what that basically means is there's a set of standards put together by various organisations, and we were lucky enough to be one of those organisations, had a lot of input into it, to basically make sure that there was a degree of continuity and consistency with training. So the training has more or less been divided into three sections now. So you've got primary strategies, which is what Safe Wards is about. There's about four or five things that fit in with primary strategies. And that's basically about trying to make the patient stay as comfortable as possible, as non-threatening as possible, as calming as possible. So you'll have Safe Wards playing a massive part in that. You'll have a way of understanding and care planning called positive behavior support, which ties in with, you know, the motivations and the function of behavior. And of course, people sometimes make, you know, different decisions when they get quite anxious and quite concerned about what's going on around them. We use a risk management tool called BROSIT, which identifies people's current presentations when they start to get anxious and agitated, which is useful for the patient themselves and useful for us. So that's taught on the training, but also taught on the wards as well. So you've got almost like a two-pronged assault on staff in the sense of, you know, this is the culture we work within the wards, but it's also what you're taught on the courses. And that's had a massive impact. Steve and the team in nursing have done a fantastic job in looking at the reduction of things like restrictive practices across the board and ally that to Safe Wards and the other primary strategies. The second strategy then is things like conflict resolution, conflict management, care planning, de-escalation training, which to us is the second most important part of the training. Because if you get the primary strategies right, you'll have less to de-escalate and less conflict on the wards. But clearly you can't make everybody happy, and there will be people who come in extremely unwell, who find the world quite scary, really, quite frightening. And feel quite threatened by what's going on around them. So their anxiety levels could increase. Therefore, the staff are taught, and they're very good at it now, with things like de-escalation. The last bit is the bit we want to be using less and less of, and that's the restrictive bit. So we'll teach staff how to physically manage challenging behaviour, supporting people through crisis and chaos. And then there's rapid trank, which is the use of some medications to slow people's behaviours down and support them through that. And then there's seclusion training, where we might have to put somebody or ask them sometimes to be in a small room away from people under constant observation. And then sometimes we'll use long-term segregation, where the person might be in a place like their bedroom, supported by staff, but just to manage the risk of them assaulting anybody else. And then the last bit of the training would be the patient review and the patient support. So the review bit would be, what have we learned about the patient? What have they learned about us? What can we add to the care plan? What can we take away from the care plan? We'll use a tool called an advanced statement, where we'll ask the patient what choices do they have, and what control and what empowerment will they have over how we might manage them when things are difficult for them. And then the other bit that we'll use with both the patient and the staff is post and support, of which the trust has been investing in over the years, really, but really committed to the investment over the last year with things like crisis support and management that a large number of staff have been trained in now. And that's massively beneficial, because clearly some of our patients have been traumatised in the past. So the way that we might end up looking after them and supporting them could re-traumatise them. It's possible. We try to avoid it at all costs, but it is possible. So the more support we can give them about things are safe, they're safe, emotionally and physically, the better. And now we support the mental health of our own staff as well is massively important. So yeah, those are the four strands of the training, really. The primary strategies, secondary strategies, the restrictive ones, and then what have we learned and how do we support people after we've done something restrictive with them?
Okay, thank you, Gary. That's really helpful. So, Steve, I'll just come back to yourself, if I may. So, for the final question, can you explain the way Safe Wards is managed and monitored by the Trust, and then from your personal observations, why the use of this model is important in dealing with aggressive or difficult situations on wards? And I'd add to that about the sort of the impact you feel that it's making on patients. And Gary's talked about some of that there, and the sort of the positivity that's created, and the sort of impact that can have on the culture within a ward. So just to sort of talk around about that, if you could, please.
And first of all, a big thank you for Gary and his team as well, who you know have been spearheading the delivery of training and supporting patients and service users for a long time now on this. And it is very much a journey, really. And I think what Safe Wards does is it gives us a bit of structure to that journey. And the idea is that Safe Wards, you know, it doesn't stop once we've implemented the modules. It continues into the way that we do things and deliver care to service users. So it's hugely positive. And we've seen some of the positive outcomes from Safe Wards as well, through the reduction in prescribing of hypnotics in some of our mental health wards. We've seen patient satisfaction surveys becoming more positive. Yeah, I think we can safely say over the last few years as well, we've also seen a reduction in restrictive interventions as well across all our inpatient services. So it's hugely positive and it's hugely beneficial. How we monitor it in the trust? Okay, so we encourage all wards, all mental health wards we have in the trust to adopt the modules. We monitor it through our restrictive practice and monitoring group, which meets every other month. It's made up myself, Gary, and key people from across the organisation. And we try and support each other in how we deliver the modules, but also it's keeping the modules alive as well. And like I say, it's building into the way we do things as that main primary strategy for reducing restrictive interventions and reducing restrictive practice overall, really. So we've been hugely, hugely positive in terms of our journey. We've got it now on across all 20 inpatient mental health wards we have in the organisation. I think what it does is it moves that thinking from containment to engagement, and that's the key driver to it. It's that thinking of, let's do things differently, let's challenge our practice, and let's involve our service users in that as well. And I think that's what it enables clinicians to do really well. I think that kind of sums it up in a bit of a nutshell, really. But I think the big thing for me is moving from containment to engagement and creating that least restrictive environment for our service users to get better in.
Thank you, Sue. That does sound a very positive way to finish this podcast. So that's it for this edition of the MPFT podcast. You can subscribe and listen to previous episodes by searching for the MPFT podcast by the usual platforms. It just leaves me to say a big thank you to my guests, Steve Martin and Gary Firkins, and also to thank you for listening. Thank you, and bye-bye.